We are talking today with John Buchanan. He is author of the book Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. John, thanks for spending time with us today.
Mike, thank you for having me.
If you could begin, tell us what was the motivation in writing your book, Fixing America?
Well, I've been an activist my whole life. I was an anti-Vietnam War activist from 1970 until the end of the war. I was an anti-Richard Nixon activist, a pro-impeach Richard Nixon activist for 2.5 years from the time of the Watergate break-in until he resigned from office. And I was an activist in the 1980s in Los Angeles to get Nelson Mandela out of prison. And so I've always been an activist, and I've always seen in those three examples that activism worked and succeeded in reaching its goal. And I was never traditionally political. I had only voted for president twice in my life, for Jimmy Carter in 76, and I went out of my way to register to vote for Al Gore in Miami in 2000, only to have my vote stolen. And I became political because George Bush was in office.
What were the circumstances that gelled where you decided that you needed to put these ideas that are in your book down on paper?
What happened was that as a result of some of my work last fall, most notably the now infamous Bush Nazi stories in the New Hampshire Gazette, John McConnell, the 89-year-old founder of Earth Day, who lives in Denver now, called me, and we had a one-hour conversation on October 13th last year, and he asked me to run for president. He said that he thought I had the kind of courage and conviction that I should run for president. What I didn't know in that conversation the first day was actually who he was, and that his friends had included 33 Nobel Prize winners and three Secretaries General of the UN. So we spoke for an hour that first day, and I told Mr. McConnell that I wasn't interested in running for office, but I would like to write a platform with him for a really serious new third party that truly represented the interests of we the people over they, the giant corporations. So Mr. McConnell and I began work on that, and I just basically sat down with a legal pad and said to myself, you know, if I were to run for president or were to get elected president, what are the things that are wrong with the country that need to be fixed, and how would you fix them, and why is no major political candidate talking about those things? So I came up with, you know, the pretty obvious stuff, that we're ruled by corporations, that lobbyists are the real instruments of subversion, that war profiteering is the career of choice inside the Beltway for Washington insiders and former government officials, that the corporate-controlled mass media has failed to properly inform the American public, and probably most important, that we the people, if we really own this government, as Thomas Jefferson said we did, have failed miserably in our responsibilities of ownership. So that was the basic framework for it. Then on November 13th, a gentleman named Bob Furtick, who's the founder and CEO of the large Democratic website, Democrats.com, he had been posting stuff about the Bush Nazi stories and follow-ups to the Bush Nazi story, and he called me on November 13th, and he came up with the wild idea that I challenge Bush and run in the Republican New Hampshire primary. So I told him that I had to sleep on that, and that Mr. McConnell had already asked me, and I had declined to run for anything, but I thought that was kind of an interesting idea to challenge him head on. And so I said that I couldn't do that unless I could really do it with integrity, and I didn't know what a Republican was, so I would find out. So I went to Google, believe it or not, and I Googled conservative Republican values, and lo and behold, I found a smaller government, lower taxes, no military misadventures overseas, and strong protection of the Constitution. So I went, man, you know, not only am I a conservative Republican, but we all ought to be conservative Republicans if that's what one really is. So I agreed to do it. I moved up to New Hampshire on January 2nd and lived in New Hampshire for the month of January, and I ran against him as the truth candidate, a.k.a. the 911 truth candidate. And I ran as a journalist who tried to speak directly from factual material that I could support from research that I had done, rather than rhetoric and political speeches that are just a lot of hot air. And what I found in New Hampshire and since is that the people of this country are desperate to hear the truth, and that if you go out and just look them in the eye and tell them the truth, no matter what their question is, then there's not that much difference between Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives if you take away the volatile issues like abortion and gun control and same-sex marriage. So that was the genesis of the book. I tied for second place in the New Hampshire primary on January 27th, and I beat 12 other Republicans, some of whom spent as much as $500,000 on their campaign, and I spent $3,000. And I got more Republican votes than the Democrats, Dick Gephardt, Al Sharpton, and Carol Moseley Braun combined, which I thought was a pretty amazing thing. Dick Gephardt had served in the Congress for many, many years, and I got three times as many votes for president as he did, which was a very telling little factoid, I think.
Did any of the media outside of New Hampshire cover as well as you did in that race?
Absolutely. I got a phenomenal amount of publicity across the country on fairly major radio stations. The CBS station here in Seattle had me on, KGO in San Francisco, the giant Christian right-wing station in Tampa, Florida had me on. And what was interesting, going back for one second to the point I made about people being desperate to hear the truth, what I thought was really interesting was that typically these radio producers would call me up and ask me to do 20 minutes, and I would get so many calls that I would end up doing 2 hours. It was really amazing. And the last week of the campaign, I was literally doing radio and newspaper and online interviews like 8 hours a day. And internationally as well, I got coverage in Germany, Austria, Holland, England. Indie media had done a lot of dissemination of the original Bush Nazi stories. So indie media was largely responsible for the international press that I got as the so-called people's candidate. But if you go to Google and put in John Buchanan, president 2004, it's amazing what comes up. I mean, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, anarchists, socialists, neo-Nazis, they all have blogs saying that I should get elected president and that they supported my position on the things that are in the book, which is just profoundly odd to me, actually.
Maybe we can talk a bit about the issues in your book, and then after that we can get back to kind of stuff that's happened since New Hampshire, because they're both fascinating areas to cover. In your book, you've divided into sections, and the first part talks about the rise of the corporate state. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Let me make a point first about how I open all of my talks on this so-called national truth tour that is designed to impact the votes of Republicans and Christians on Election Day related to some of the very specific and troubling things that are in the book that relate directly to the Bush administration. But when I go out every night, the first thing I do is say I'd like to get a reading of the room, and so I want to ask you a couple of questions. Let me see a show of hands of those of you who believe that the Fortune 500 own and operate this government and control every aspect of public policy. Needless to say, 98 or 99% of the hands go up. And then I say, well, you know, let me see a show of hands of those of you who believe that Thomas Jefferson was telling the truth and that we the people own this government and that it's our responsibility to exercise public policy. And one or two hands go up. And last night in Sacramento and Monday night in Dover, New Hampshire, zero hands went up to the question of whether we the people own the government. So then the second question I ask is how many of you think that truth and honor still matter in this culture? And at that point there are snickers and laughs and, you know, wry noises. And then I say, how many of you think that truth and honor have been flushed down the toilet in this country in the era of popular culture? And 98% of the hands go up. So in terms of what's in that first section, the rise of the corporate state, I give some historical perspective from people like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who talked about the fact that we had to make a choice 50 or 60 or 70 years ago, that we had to make a clear choice between either great wealth being aggregated in the hands of a few or spread out widely among the population, or we would ultimately have to make a choice between democracy and fascism. And Justice Brandeis actually had made that point most succinctly and said that point blank, that we would eventually have to make a choice between democracy and fascism if great wealth was accumulated in the hands of a few. And I don't think there's anyone listening today who would disagree with the premise that virtually all wealth has accumulated in the hands of a few. And one of the more shocking facts that I discovered in researching the book was that basically 1/3 of 1% of the population control the great majority of the assets of this country, and the greatest marker of the demographic of that particular 1/3 of 1% is that they earn personal incomes of $1 million a year or more. The other fact that I sort of knew, but I didn't understand the extent of, was the matrix of major shareholders of the Fortune 500 and how they all share ownership of one another, and that the largest shareholders in Fortune 500 companies are typically other Fortune 500 companies. So the three things that I trace it back to in the book are that all of this really began to happen 30 years ago. The first thing that happened was the wave of mergers and acquisitions that began in the late 1970s and really accelerated under Ronald Reagan, where companies started buying companies, and you ended up with the phenomenon of global. Well, originally they were called multinational. Now they're called transnational corporations that do global business everywhere on Earth. The second factor was the consolidation of the media. 30 years ago, there were approximately 600 media companies that owned and operated television stations, radio stations, and newspapers. And although they were typically wealthy families and among the wealthiest families in a particular city or town, they were civic-minded. They weren't perceived in most cases as being evil media barons, and especially in the case of television station license holders, they really had a stake in the community. Now we see that only six companies essentially control the entire U.S. media, and that they in turn are owned by giant transnational corporations, the classic example being NBC. NBC is owned by General Electric. General Electric has very significant business interests in nuclear power and armaments and defense. So it would be a very naive news executive or reporter at an NBC television station who would risk their career on trying to break a story about the dangers of nuclear power or how war profiteering has become the career of choice in Washington. And so I build that case out just in a very succinct way to lay the groundwork for the second section of the book, which is called The Corporate Lobbyist as Instrument of Subversion. And in that section, it starts off, the first chapter of that section, starts off with what is probably one of the two or three most startling facts that I learned in researching the book. And again, every night when I go out to speak, I say, somebody yell out a number if you think you're well-informed, but tell me how many full-time corporate lobbyists there are in Washington who call on the 535 members of Congress every day. And sometimes it's 500 and 1,000, and some nights somebody else 5,000, 10,000 one night. Well, the actual number is 25,000. There are 25,000 professional, full-time corporate lobbyists who represent major global U.S.-based, but not always, business interests and call on 535 members of Congress. That's 48 lobbyists for every member of the House and Senate, for anybody who doesn't want to do the math in their head real quick. And the even more startling statistic is that in 2002, according to the watchdog group Political Moneyline, they spent $1.6 billion, that's billion with a B, to have their way with members of Congress. And that, since it's illegal to directly give members of Congress and state legislatures cash and bribe them directly, there are two major avenues of influence. The obvious first one is that you cannot get elected to Congress anymore without being pre-approved by these most powerful lobbyists, who then go out and raise money for your candidacy and do what's called bundling, where they can raise large increments of money without violating the individual donation thresholds that exist under the Federal Election Commission. And then the other way they do it, which is probably well known to your listeners, is that they take members of Congress, when they're getting ready to vote on key bills, to Hawaii, Thailand, out for extravagant dinners, and wine them and dine them and have Luciano Pavarotti sing for them or whatever they do. And, you know, I like to think that I'm a person of character and a strong-willed person, as I'm sure you do, and I just don't understand how it's humanly possible that anyone could resist that kind of onslaught. You know, everyone has a threshold of integrity beyond which you turn to jelly, I assume, and when that kind of money is being spent and that kind of relentless assault is being brought against you every day directly with the goal of affecting your votes in Congress, that's a perfect example of how we the people really don't have any chance in this government, because even if you or I or your listeners want to get on a plane or get on a bus and go to Washington and take a day off from work to go lobby their congressional delegation for something that's really important to their community, unless you're taking a big bag of money with you, there's no way that you're going to have the same kind of impact that these full-time corporate lobbyists do inside the Beltway. The other startling fact about them is that many, many of them earn salaries of more than $1 million a year. So they're in that elite one-third of 1% of the corporate ruling class. It's not uncommon for them to earn salaries of $5 to $10 million a year. And a number of them make more than $20 million a year lobbying Congress. I think that's a crime against everything this country stands for. And in my presidential platform and in the solutions section of the book at the end, I call for a ban on professional lobbying, that only citizens should have the right to lobby and there should be no price tag attached.
Yeah, my understanding is a significant number of those people who are doing the lobbying are actually former elected representatives and or their staff.
Correct.
So, big revolving door there.
Exactly. I was going to say the term used in Washington, especially with regard to the next section of the book about the war profiteers, is the revolving door syndrome. You go back and forth and back and forth, and you're on one side of the equation, you're supposedly a public servant, and yet to my point about integrity having a threshold, you can't really be an effective public servant if part of your attention is constantly on the fact that after this term is up, or if you decide not to run for re-election or don't get appointed again to the civil post that you have, that you can increase your salary 10 or 20 or 50 times over just by going through the revolving door and becoming a lobbyist and now calling on those that you were working with as a so-called public servant just a year ago or 2 years ago or whatever it is. And again, that's a dynamic that I think perverts the entire process of how government works and that doesn't get talked about. The media never talks about this stuff. You never see an analysis of this on the evening news or on Nightline. You know, someone like Bill Moyers will do a show about it, but Bill Moyers, despite, you know, his heroic work, reaches a minuscule audience in terms of any kind of number that's going to directly affect the public debate on any kind of a national scale.
Let's talk a bit about war profiteering and the military-industrial complex. If we look at today's examples, things like Halliburton in Iraq seems really to be a good example of where that's gotten out of control. But I've been doing some extra reading lately on the history of war profiteering, and I'm surprised, or and I shouldn't be, surprised to find out that in a lot of ways that's nothing new. That's been going on since, you know, since the Civil War.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I learned in reporting the Bush Nazi stories is that the Bush family have been war profiteers for 100 years, going back to before World War I. And Samuel Bush, who was the father of Prescott Bush, he was this president's great-grandfather on his father's side, was a notorious war profiteer in World War I. He worked in concert with Remington Arms, which was owned by the DuPont family. And one of Samuel Bush's associates in World War I was named Samuel Pryor. And Samuel Pryor was immortalized as one of the minor players in the famous book, The Merchants of Death, that chronicled the war profiteers in World War I. And then since World War I, I now know from my reporting in the New Hampshire Gazette and since that not only did they back the Bolsheviks in the Russian Revolution, but they also backed Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin. And, you know, literally 15 or 20 million people died innocently in the Holocaust and in the purges in Stalinist Russia, while Prescott Bush and W. Averill Harriman and his younger brother Roland Harriman and George Herbert Walker, the maternal great-grandfather of George W. Bush, shamelessly war profiteered and then covered that activity up for 70 years. And it still has not come out in the mainstream press to the extent that it should, so the American people can understand just how criminal the Bush family has been and is under this president. But you're absolutely right about the long history of it. One of my newfound heroes is a former Marine general that I'm sure many of your listeners are knowledgeable about, General Smedley Butler, the two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner, who is one of the top five American military heroes in all of our history, probably. He served for 33 years and 4 months in the Marine Corps, won the Congressional Medal of Honor twice, and when he made his retirement speech in 1931, he made the famous comment that war is just a racket. And he said that a racket is best described, I believe, as something that's not what it appears to be, and its true nature is only known to a few insiders who perpetrate it. And I think that's a perfect characterization of the run-up to the war in Iraq and what we see happening in Iraq now. It certainly is not the export of freedom and democracy, and it certainly is not any attempt to stand for the values that the United States of America represent. It is, in fact, a military-industrial complex racket for profiteering based on greed rather than patriotism. The great English writer Samuel Johnson once said very famously that patriotism is the last resort of scoundrels. And I think that that's a very telling observation of George W. Bush and why I hope and pray that whether he's reelected or not on November 2nd, that he and his family will someday be held accountable for their long history of war profiteering and brutality and brought to justice, as the president likes to say, of Al-Qaeda and the terrorist. What you see in Washington now, well, Daddy Bush is another good example, and I'm sure many of your listeners, because you have a well-informed audience, know this as well, but the famous Washington private equity fund, the Carlyle Group, a $13 billion a year private enterprise that's in the war profiteering business. The major players besides Daddy Bush have been James A. Baker III, the Bush family crony who went down to Florida in 2000 and engineered the theft of a presidential election and did business with the Bin Laden family from the 1970s onward, is a classic example of what goes on. You have this gigantic, monolithic company that's known as the Ex-President's Club. They do business with Saudi Arabia and other notoriously evil regimes around the world, and because they are a privately held company, the media and the citizenry have no true access to what their business is, how they influence Washington, and so on, except you get books like House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger, which, you know, does some pretty serious reporting on how evil the Carlyle Group is, but even he isn't able to sit with public records like you can go through for a publicly traded company and really understand the numbers and the deals and the relationships and all of that. Then you get the Big Three players in terms of defense contracts now are Lockheed, Raytheon, and Boeing. And Raytheon was the big winner immediately after 9/11, when the stock market reopened after its closure as a result of 9/11. The single biggest winner was Raytheon. Their stock went through the roof because of the anticipation of a lot of the homeland security business that they would get. And these companies have profited shamelessly from both the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, as well as the attacks of 9/11. Interestingly enough, Smedley Butler proposed back in 1931 that there should not be profits made from war, that companies that are successful, that are making money, that have the kinds of resources and capabilities that need to be used in a time of national defense should do the patriotic thing and deliver those products at cost and not make a profit. And publicly waive any notion of profiting from the tragedy of war. Now you see the opposite, where they gleefully profit, and it's a feeding frenzy every time there's a military encounter by this country. And George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, by their own admission, frequently, including during the debates, speak of the concept of endless war, that we will be at war for generations to come as we hunt down these terrorist organizations around the country. And it just astonishes me that the American people are stupid enough to buy into that fantasy and not see it for what it is.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with John Buchanan. He is author of Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. It's interesting, I saw in the movie, the documentary, The Corporation, I don't know if you've seen that, but they mention in there, and I had heard this long ago and forgotten it, that Smedley Butler was actually hired by corporations to do a coup in D.C.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that is two chapters in the book. It's in a section called Are We Living in a Neo-Fascist State? And the first chapter in that section uses an essay by a noted scholar named Lawrence W. Britt, who studied all the modern fascist states of the 20th century, the most obvious being Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany, but also Franco's Spain and Papadopoulos's Greece and Pinochet's Chile and a number of others, and identified 14 characteristic points of what all of these modern fascist states had in common. So after that chapter, I have a chapter that starts off by saying, for those of you who don't think it's possible that a fascist dictatorship could be brought to the United States, you need to understand that a serious attempt was made to do that in 1934, and that along with the story of the Nazi past of the Bush family, this is another completely missing a chapter of American history. It doesn't exist in history books, elementary school books, scholarly texts, nowhere. It's been completely expunged from the public record. So I found out about a book called The Plot to Seize the White House, written in 1972 by a noted historian and biographer named Jules Archer. And incredibly, this book came out in 1972, details the whole plot and how they did hire Smedley Butler. The plan included Remington Arms and the DuPont family. Remington Arms was going to provide the arms. The plot was basically led by J.P. Morgan and a few other elite families, including Prescott Bush, through a shadowy organization called the American Liberty League. The American Liberty League was to liberty back then what the Patriot Act is to patriotism now. It's an Orwellian use of language that has nothing to do with the real underlying intent of what the activity was. They originally wanted General Douglas MacArthur to lead the coup. The plan was to recruit a 500,000-man army of disgruntled World War I veterans. The only mistake they made, and the only reason we're not living in a fascist state right now under a dictator, is that they hired the wrong guy. They hired Smedley Butler because he was a hero to World War I veterans. That began on July 1st of 1933 and went on until November of 1934, and Smedley Butler played along until he understood exactly what was going on and who the lead plotters were. And then he went to the Philadelphia News newspaper. The editor of the Philadelphia News was a friend of his, and he in turn assigned a very famous reporter of his day. His name was Paul Comley French. And this is a very relevant point to the political climate that we live in today and the arrogance of Bush and Cheney in terms of, you know, telling us on the record what they're going to do and what's going to happen, as in there will be another terrorist attack. It may happen before the election. We may have to cancel or postpone the election. And so Paul Comley French back then went and sought out the lead plotters on the record. They knew that he was a newspaper reporter, and they talked to him on the record about the need to overthrow the U.S. government and abolish the presidency. So their plan, now these are all families and companies that had just backed Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler had just come to power, and what their plan was to assassinate FDR, abolish the office of the presidency, and replace the office of president with a civil dictator who would serve for as long as they wanted him to be in power. When I read the plot to seize the White House, I bought back in the spring what is believed to be the last known copy in print. I paid $650 for it to a rare book dealer in Boston who said that as far as he knows, this was the last known copy of it, and I wouldn't have included it in my book if I didn't have a copy of The Plot to Seize the White House, because it's such an outrageous sounding claim to say that they tried to overthrow the U.S. government. But even after I read the book and did some additional research and reported on it in these two chapters in Fixing America, there was still a part of me that just couldn't grasp the fact that it could actually be real. So when I went back to the National Archives and the Library of Congress in early August with the Guardian newspaper, which ran a Bush Nazi story several weeks ago, when the Guardian reporter went into Washington to have lunch with a colleague, I figured I was at the Library of Congress and had some free time, so I would go upstairs and try to find the microfilm transcripts of the actual hearings of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives in November of 1934 as a result of Smedley Butler blowing the whistle. Those hearings began with secret testimony in New York from Smedley Butler and Paul Comley French, and then as a result of that secret testimony, they reconvened about a week later on Capitol Hill, and there were public hearings. In those hearings, it was established, among other things, that they thought Hitler was doing the right thing, that Hitler understood that because our, and this is another very relevant thing to bear in mind about the state of affairs that we're in today, that because the country was under attack and there were outside agitators who wanted to destroy America and destroy everything America stands for, precisely the same rhetoric you get today from Bush and Cheney, that it was an acceptable thing to install a Hitler-type dictatorship. They talked about the fact that because there were so many disgruntled unemployed people from the Depression and so many disgruntled troops from World War I who had not been given their bonuses for having served in combat, that it was okay to build concentration camps and round up the loudmouthed unemployed and World War I veterans and put them in concentration camps at forced labor. That is a matter of public record. And so I would point out to your listeners that these are public documents that are readily available at the Library of Congress, and anybody with high school level research skills can go there and look at these transcripts and see for themselves the kind of power structure that we're talking about in this country and have always been talking about, and the threat that we face today from George W. Bush and the Bush family militarist cronies.
Do you know, with the part of the testimony that was secret that was held in New York, do they still have actual records of that, which one day might be turned over to the public, or are there no records of that?
There's records of everything. As a matter of fact, I went back with a reporter I probably shouldn't name, but he's a fairly well-known national reporter. And he showed up on my doorstep in Kennebunkport, Maine, several weeks ago, and had been told about my whole saga with my Secret Service detention and arrest in Miami and all the stuff that we'll talk about in a little bit. But he wanted to have me come to Washington and show him the documents. So I had, as I mentioned, seen the McCormick-Dickstein Smedley-Butler transcripts back in early August, so I knew exactly where they were and, you know, how to easily go back and see them. So when we went back, just as I did when I stumbled onto the Bush-Nazi documents, I got very lucky and I found out that there had been earlier hearings in the spring and in June of 1934 of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee under the same theme, which was investigation of Nazi activities and propaganda in the U.S. The first Bush, Harriman, Nazi front business that was seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act in August of 1942 was a German shipping line known as Hamburg America Line. There had always been these rumors that I had seen, but I had never seen confirmation of, that among the many things Hamburg America Line did was bring Nazi spies into the U.S. and operate violent brown shirt organizations inside the U.S., offer free passage to Germany in the late 1920s and early 30s for American citizens who would be willing to go to Germany and proselytize for Hitler, etc. And I stumbled on to 3 weeks ago in early September or mid-September, hundreds of pages of documents from the summer of 1934 that was the McCormick-Dickstein's Committee investigation of Hamburg America Line. They interviewed the alien Nazi spies that were brought in on Hamburg America Line ships. They interviewed the publisher of a Nazi newspaper in the U.S. that Hamburg America Line surreptitiously supported with what appeared to be advertising revenues. The only problem was that they were paying a huge multiple for their ads of what other advertisers paid, and it was uncovered that that was a secret mechanism for being able to fund this Nazi newspaper. There were Nazis identified by name who testified before the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, and when asked if they were members of the Nazi Party, said yes. And they, in turn, talked about an organization called the Friends of the New Germany that the Harrimans and George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush vigorously supported. So the point of that information is that they directly participated in Nazi subversion of the United States of America, most notably by consciously participating in smuggling Nazi spies into the U.S., and to this day, that is not public information. To answer your question, after my struggle for a year to try to really get this story out to the mainstream media, I elected to give all of these documents to this reporter, and he is trying very hard to get that story broken before the election or as soon as possible after the election. But incredibly, he has run into the same resistance I ran into, despite the fact that his credentials are much greater than mine. And the classic argument that he's gotten so far that I got is that you can't hold the sins of the grandfather against the son. Well, the first article that I wrote in the New Hampshire Gazette didn't suggest in any way that the sins of the grandfather ought to be held against the son, and the lead paragraph of the first story was after 60 years of inattention and even denial by the U.S. media, newly uncovered documents at the National Archives demonstrate that. And so the reason that I make that point is that to me what the story was about was the 70-year cover-up and the fact that in none of the Bush family political campaigns, going back to 1948 when Prescott Bush ran unsuccessfully, I'm sorry, in 1950, when Prescott Bush ran unsuccessfully for the Senate and then was elected as a Republican from Connecticut 2 years later in 1952. None of this surfaced in his campaign. None of this surfaced in any of George Herbert Walker Bush's campaigns, not during his presidency, and none of this has surfaced during George W. Bush's governorship of Texas or campaign for president. when I argued with the national editors of the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times a year ago, most notably Tom Furlong, who's the deputy national editor of the Los Angeles Times. We had 3-hour-long conversations about the documents and what they meant. And I had hope that the LA Times would actually report the story, which would have broken it all over the world, needless to say. And in the third conversation, he said to me, in good faith, I don't think he was being as criminal as Bill Keller from the New York Times, who I hold in utter and complete contempt, which is also a significant part of my book, how the New York Times has misreported a lot of important stories or failed to report, including the 1934 coup attempt. But when I talked to Mr. Furlong the third time, he said, I just don't see the news value here. You're looking at a bunch of old documents, never been commented on publicly. They're not part of, you know, the historical text of the country. It's old history. And I was just not able to convince him of the relevance. What I think the relevance has been and is, when I first sent the documents to Stephen Fowle, the editor and publisher of the New Hampshire Gazette, which is the oldest newspaper in the country, and which gave Samuel Adams his first byline in 1756. When I first sent the documents to Stephen Fowle, I made a very important point, I thought. And I said, Mr. Fowle, the thing that you need to understand right off the bat is what my motives are for taking this story public. If George W. Bush were being hailed on the editorial pages of every major newspaper in this country as the most compassionate Republican president in American history, and if there were being op-ed pieces written every week that he is the most socially progressive and humanistic president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then I would have forgotten what I saw at the National Archives, and I would have let sleeping dogs lie. But in light of the fact that he's just invaded a country and toppled its government based on false pretense and propaganda, just as Hitler did in Poland in 1939, and considering that they're rounding up people of a particular type, which are Muslims, and putting them in to concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay, and since they're subverting the Constitution and traditional constitutional rights as they've been known in this country for 200 years under the Patriot Act, I submit that these documents are very relevant because what we're witnessing is a repeat of what Hitler did in his rise to power in Nazi Germany in 1932, 1933, 1934. I believe today that's truer than ever. I defy anyone to look me in the eye and give me a reasoned explanation of their belief that you cannot compare the Bush administration to the Hitler regime in terms of what they have specifically done to subvert their governments, bring their populations under their thumb, and wreak havoc on the world. And if George W. Bush is reelected on November 2nd, I shudder to think what will happen to this country, and that's why I'm out on the road trying to do my little part by bringing these truths out to people across the country that he is unfit for re-election and not only should be voted out of office, but should be held accountable for his crimes against this country, which I consider to be treason.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with John Buchanan. He is author of Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. John, I don't know if you're familiar with Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty. When I had him here on the show, he, and paraphrasing here, he had said in his research, which he had felt he had done more research than anything that had been done up to that time on the whole connection between the Bush family and the Nazis, he said there just wasn't a smoking gun there to really show that Prescott Bush and the Bush family back then knowingly were supporting the Nazis. Have you found stuff that would contradict that?
Yes, absolutely. And I would be interested in hearing the reaction of Mr. Phillips to what I'm about to report. But my mother raised me never to quit in a righteous battle. And so I, despite everything that I've been through, I never gave up the belief that this the smoking gun would in fact materialize, and that sooner or later the full story would be told, and I cling to that belief. When I mentioned earlier that I went back to the National Archives and Library of Congress with the reporter from The Guardian, last April I had met, she had found me on the internet, a German author and a journalist named Eva Schweitzer, who lives in Berlin but also has an apartment in New York, so she goes back and forth, and she's written 6 books in Germany. She has a very explosive book that just came out on October 6th, titled The USA and the Holocaust. Beginning last spring, I helped her find all of the documents that I had found at the National Archives and Library of Congress. Among those documents are documents that show that Prescott Bush was a shareholder in the most infamous of the Nazi front businesses, which was known as Union Banking Corporation, known as UBC, which was a money laundering operation. What caused the investigations by the U.S. government that led to the 5 seizures of the 5 major businesses in the fall of 1942 was a story in the New York Herald Tribune, July 30th of 1942. The headline was, Hitler's Angel Has $3 Million in U.S. Bank. The person that the story referred to was the Nazi industrialist Fritz Thyssen. His name is spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. He was the wealthiest man in Germany. He controlled the steel and coal industries in Germany, and therefore largely built, along with his partner, who was also a steel and coal baron named Friedrich Flick, the two of them built the Nazi war machine. There have been studies done and information published about the direct proportion of the Nazi war machine in terms of pig iron and steel and coal and all of the resources that were used to arm Hitler and build Nazi Germany, and that's a matter of public record. I have the documents that show that Prescott Bush and the Harrimans were shareholders in Union Banking Corporation. Prescott Bush, in his own diaries, which Eva Schweitzer found at Columbia University and reports on in her book, in his own handwriting, Prescott Bush talks about how he ran the day-to-day operations of Union Banking Corporation and the other Thyssen controlled businesses. Prescott Bush and the Harrimans were also partners in the Wall Street private banking and investment firm Brown Brothers Harriman, which exists to this day. So I hope one way or another Mr. Phillips will get to hear this interview and ponder what I'm about to inform him of in addition to that. But when I went back to the archives with the Guardian reporter, once again I got lucky, and there were about 2 dozen boxes of documents that came from the FBI investigation, massive FBI investigation of IG Farben, the giant industrial cartel that made the poison gases for the death camps and operated and managed the death camp at Auschwitz. And I was just going through, you know, files. Those documents had been declassified in September of 2003, so they were very recently declassified. And lo and behold, I found documents that link them directly to IG Farben and to the death camp at Auschwitz. Polish Newsweek, known as Newsweek Polska, had reported that story in very early 2003, a short news item in the Periscope section of the magazine, just like we get here in the States, under the headline, A Bush Family Profited from Slave Labor at Auschwitz. Incredibly, U.S. Newsweek spiked that story and never ran it. I spoke myself, which is in my first New Hampshire Gazette article, to Michael Isikoff, the Newsweek reporter who became rich and famous reporting about the sperm stain on Monica Lewinsky's dress. So he built a career out of reporting on Bill Clinton's sex life, but he would not report on the Nazi past of the Bush family, and I publicly reported on that in my first New Hampshire Gazette article. Eva Schweitzer and I were back at the archives 3 weeks ago when this reporter that I mentioned was there with us. And since then, between the two of us, she has found documents showing that they moved Nazi assets into Chile toward the end of the war and after the war. I have in my possession that they did business with named Nazis in Switzerland, Brazil, Argentina, and Panama after the war. And Fritz Thiessen died in Argentina in 1951, and that was when the assets of Union Banking Corporation were liquidated, and Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker received $1.5 million for their shares in Union Banking Corporation. So I really fail to understand how Kevin Phillips could get it so wrong and not be able to do what a low-level freelance reporter from Miami, namely myself, was able to go do. I have nowhere near his journalistic credentials or authorial credentials, but I have documents that he ought to see, and maybe that will clarify the facts for him.
What was it that inspired you to write the original article in the New Hampshire Gazette?
What originally happened, actually, and this, except for the fact I was abducted by the Secret Service and then arrested in Miami, this to me is probably the most amazing part of the whole story. I lived in Los Angeles for 14 years, and I had a very good life in Los Angeles. I owned an advertising agency and PR firm for a while. I was a travel writer, was in the music business. I did a lot of fun stuff when I lived in L.A. And so I had had a very good year in 2002, and I had been an international luxury travel writer for National Magazine. So I went to Paris twice. I went to Africa with Sir Richard Branson. I went to 19 countries in 2002 as a travel writer. And I don't like to repeat myself, and I'd like to always look for something new and different to do. So after having such a great year in 2002 and ending up going to Africa to Richard Branson's game resort in late November, I got it in my head that I wanted to do something just completely different. So I decided that what I really wanted to do was move back to L.A. and become a movie screenwriter. So I figured that at my advanced age and, you know, knowing how brutally competitive the script writing market was, that I would have to really come up with a whopper of a movie script. So I found at the website takebackthemedia.com a flash movie titled Bush is Not a Nazi, So Stop Saying So. And it was this really cool flash movie that talked about how they profited from slave labor at Auschwitz and whatever. And frankly, I didn't really believe it. I just thought that it was so over the top that it could trigger, you know, an interesting plot for a movie script. So I approached this movie script as a journalist and investigative reporter, and I wrote a movie script where everybody in the movie is real except me, and I just change my name from John Buchanan to John Brady. I keep the same initials. I just change my name, and the editor of the newspaper I supposedly work for in Washington is, you know, made up, Washington Weekly, whatever. But otherwise, George W. Bush is real, Rumsfeld is real, Cheney is real, Daddy Bush, James A. Baker, the Carlyle Group, the actual CEO of the Carlyle Group at the time, whose name was Frank Carlucci. And so I came up with a plot. And the plot of the movie, which strangely enough, by the way, takes place right now. It was structured to take place culminating right before the election with the destruction of the entire administration by the revelation in the mass media of the Nazi past of the family. But what the script was about, it's called Project Clear Vision. And Project Clear Vision was a super secret anthrax development program that the CIA ran illegally beginning under Reagan at Fort Detrick, Maryland. And for those of your listeners who don't know, Fort Detrick, Maryland is supposedly the location where the Ames strain of anthrax that was used in the anthrax letters after 9/11 was engineered. So I cooked up this plot that the German principals of Bayer AG, the Bayer Aspirin Company, which was one of the three companies that grew out of IG Farben after the war, that they had these documents in their vault all these years, and that I found out from Bayer's own annual report from 2001, from 2000, that they were in a serious financial difficulty and that they needed to have gigantic increases in pharmaceutical sales in the U.S. in 2002. And lo and behold, Bayer makes Cipro, which went through the roof after the anthrax letters. So I cooked up this plot that the Nazi principals of Bayer blackmailed Daddy Bush through the Carlyle Group into getting George W. Bush to allow the anthrax letters to be mailed as a way to save Bayer and sell Cipro and so on and so forth. And this reporter, which is supposed to be me, gets this story and, you know, goes through death threats and intimidation and all kinds of stuff to break the story that brings down the Bush administration right before the 2004 election. And the last 10 minutes of the movie is all of them resigning, all the way down to Condoleezza Rice. And there's this media feeding frenzy in the last 10 minutes of, you know, network broadcasters trying to, news broadcasters trying to get on the air that, you know, now Cheney's resigning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I wrote the script in about a month, and working furiously on it, and I researched and found that a really good agent in Los Angeles was this kid named Brad Rosenfeld at an agency called Preferred Artist. So August the 29th of 2003, I got him on the phone, which was the Thursday before the Labor Day weekend. He said, "That sounds like an interesting script to me. You know, send it to me, and I'll take a read of it over the holiday weekend." So I FedExed it to him that day. He got it on Friday, and he told me he would call me first thing Tuesday morning, the day after Labor Day. So I, you know, paced all weekend, got really neurotic. You know, I wonder if I'm going to have a career in screenwriting. And lo and behold, at noon on Tuesday, which was 9 a.m. in Los Angeles and noon in Miami, the phone rings. And he says, "John, Brad Rosenfeld, how are you?" And I go, "Great, Brad. I've been pacing all weekend. You know, what's up with the script? Did you like it?" And he says, "Well, I have good news and bad news." So I said, "Well, give me the good news first." And he said, "You have indeed written a mother of a movie script, and this could sell for a lot of money and really establish you as a screenwriter in L.A. It's a great script." And so I'm jumping up and down in my apartment and, you know, high-fiving myself. And I calm down and say, "Brad, what could possibly be the bad news?" And he says, "Nobody's going to touch this script because it's so explosive unless you can actually go find the proof that they have this Nazi past." So my bubble was immediately burst, and I said, "You know, Brad, you know, first of all, you know, I found it on the internet. I don't even know if it's true, but if it were true, I have no idea how I would go about finding it. But hey, man, if it's a matter of selling a movie script, I'll figure out a way to go do it." And once again, I just got very lucky. That was on September 2nd. And 2 weeks later, I went to the National Archives and found the documents. Now, the really depressing news is that even after publishing the stories in the New Hampshire Gazette, it turned out nobody in Hollywood would touch the script because they were terrified of the backlash that would come down on them from the Bush regime and the Bush family, because look at what they did to Michael Moore, for example, with Fahrenheit 9/11. And if that's what happened to Michael Moore with a mere documentary that has a, you know, a lot of humor in it, I shudder to think what would have happened to me if this movie had gotten made. The plan was to get the movie made and have it come out this summer, you know, just before the election, as a way of ending his presidency. And needless to say, the movie has never been made, and the script will be a collector's item by the time the election is over. But that was the genesis of the whole thing. And when I went to the archives the first day, September 17th of 2003, to be honest, when I got out of the taxi cab to walk into the archives, I consciously had this thought that these documents just couldn't exist. As much as I hate the Bush family, this is just too over the top. And I have a lot of integrity, and so the thought also crossed my mind that if the documents, in fact, did not exist, that I would have a moral responsibility to report that story and say there are these vicious Nazi rumors on the internet, and the fact is that these documents do not exist at the National Archives, etc. But within one 8-hour day, I copied 200-odd pages that proved everything that was on the internet about the seizures in 1942, and the rest is just bad theater and history now at this point.
We are talking with John Buchanan. He is author of Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right.